Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
Chavo Guerrero Jr. is my guest today here at the house. We're about to talk about GLOW Wrestling and a lot of other things, just shooting the breeze. I know you've been on Chris Jericho's podcast extensively. You guys have covered a lot of ground. So
sure.
Let's try to cover some different material and shoot the breeze. Right. Obviously, I don't think you guys have talked about GLOW.
Not really. No, man. We kind of talked about right before we started doing the second season. We weren't even knowing we were picked up yet. So we just kind of shot the shit a little bit. And, you know, but we're always, we had to start talking about, you know, the Guerreros and how crazy my dad was and stuff. But hold on. Let's get a cheers on this. We got some Broken Skull IPA right here that I've been hearing so much about. And
well, see, it was interesting. When you came by or just walked in the front door, you said, man, he goes, I want to try your beer. I was going to bring some. And I said, man, you don't like no IPA.
Oh, man, I like it all. But I'm Mexican. We like it all. We just like, I knew the Fit Finley. When I first met Fit Finley, I go, hey, man, what kind of beer do you like? He goes, cold. That's all he said. Him and Dave Taylor go, cold.
I said, but did it take you a while to make the swing? Because, man, like, basically, here, cheers.
Cheers, cheers, yeah, man.
And then an unsolicited response as far as your take on the beer.
Oh, yeah, man. It's not, you know, sometimes it hits you in the face. Some of those IPAs, man, it's like drinking a pine tree sometimes. Or you're like, wow, this is good. You could throw this down easy. What's the alcohol content on these?
6.7.
Oh, yeah. That's good. So you can.
And
you
can use a low on this because I don't like real bitter. That kind of hits mid palate. I don't like anything too up front or too far back. So it hits mid palate.
That's good. That's great.
When we came up with this beer at Elsagunna Brewing Company, myself and the owner, Rob Crocs, all sat there at a table and we had 12 or 15 beers that we both liked. And I kind of just, you know, described each one and how they hit. And we weeded them out. And then he came up with this formula, man. And I went up there after, you know, we brewed the beer, went back 25, 30 days later. And took a test beer, and I was like, I figured this process was going to take a long time because we talk about your impending project? Because you're about to come up with
a
beer.
I got a beer coming out called Guerrero Golden Ale. And I said, that's the working name right there, right? You know, so, and it's a blonde ale, but it's also called a golden ale. And the reason I went that way real quick is with IPAs and all that stuff, you start limiting your market. And you know much more than I do on this, but you start limiting your market and they see something like the IPA market is only like 5%. So you have all these companies trying to vie for that 5% now, as opposed to a lighter beer that everybody drinks. It's more like a 75%. So I don't know.
You do the numbers. I mean, Bud Light's the number one selling beer.
Right.
Probably in the world, but definitely in the United States, you know.
Is it over Coors Light?
Coors Light is number 3. I think Miller Lite's number 2. But Bud Light is number 1 by a landfall.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's to your point.
A lot of Mexicans over here, and we're taking over, man, drinking Bud Light, man.
But the Bud, you know, Light. What? I think Modelo was ahead of Corona and Tecate.
Really?
But I would think that Corona was on top. But
I'm a Corona Light guy. If I'm drinking light beers, then I can just – no, if I'm at the river, I'm throwing down Coors Lights like crazy, you know what I mean? But
that's your go-to flavor?
Yeah.
Come on, man.
I've been at Coors Lights since I was in high school, man, for sure.
Dude, I drink a ton of them.
That's Coors Lights. You throw them down, man. But if I'm, you know, if I'm going to – drink, like, you know, if I want to drink 20 beers, I'm drinking Coors Lights. If I want to drink 8 beers, I'm drinking Corona Lights. If I want to drink 1 or 2 beers, I do an IPA or something to that effect.
You know, the thing about these are 22 ounce bombers. So, I mean, it's almost 2 beers and it's 6-7, you know. I don't know. You were around. You're a little bit younger than me. You're 47?
47, yep.
So do you remember when the ice beers came out?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, Bud Ice, they had Miller Ice. What was the other one that was real big?
Goddamn.
They all had ice.
I was in Georgia at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they all had ice.
And they're about 5.5% alcohol.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, you go from drinking light beer to those ice beers, it's a little bit of a kick. Right. And so for a while they hit, but then it was like everybody kind of went back to light beers because, like, to your point, they wanted to drink 20 and be able to kind of still function. I don't want to say drive.
Sure.
We've been there and did that probably a few times going up and down the road.
That was not me. Throwing beer bottles out the side of the road and hitting the signs. That was not me. Actually, I grew up traveling with my dad and some of the guys back then. And bro, just what they used to do, man, they would never stop drinking. Harley Race and those guys, you just kept their beer full. I was in the back as a kid, and psh, every time I saw them finish a beer, I had that was my thing, give them a new beer.
That was the thing when Vader was riding with Harley Race.
Yeah.
The rule was Harley always drove and Leon rode shotgun. Right. When I hitched a ride, I was in the back seat. But the rule was by the time Harley had finished a beer, and it didn't take him long, crushed it and dumped it out the window, or handed it to Leon. He had to have another beer popped open, tab, opening turned in the right spot to hand to Harley, or there's going to be hell to pay. I mean, this is just according to...
Did he do the tomato juice with it?
No, because we was flying down the road.
Because my Uncle Mondo will tell me that when he worked with Harley one time where the main event guy didn't show up, and my Uncle Mondo was green the business, and he looked at my Uncle Mondo goes, I want to work with the kid there. So he worked with him and goes, kid, you're driving with me to the next town. And he said the whole time, back then the speedometers only went to 85. So he had it pinned. He didn't know how fast it was going because it was pinned the entire time. And every time Harley's beer would run out, he'd pour a little bit of tomato juice and the whole beer. Here you go. He had it going from the whole time. So
what was doing tomato juice? I never really got into that.
I like that because it's like it's a good hangover beer. Because it's in Mexico or this Mexican culture is called a michelada. So now you can buy those. It's almost like a Bloody Mary mix, but it's got all the stuff ready to go. You just pour a little bit in your beer and it's sometimes a Bloody Mary. I can have one. Sometimes too much for me. But you just throw a little bit in your beer, and it's a good hangover cure. You just start drinking, three or four or five of those, you're ready to go again.
So where are you at with respect to your beer? Have y'all done? Y'all got a formula? Because going back to my story, when we brewed this dude, I went up there and tasted it twice. Right. I said, that's it. And I slept on it, and I said, that's it.
It's not heavy. It's not. Sometimes with the IPA, man, it knocks you, hits you in the face, which I like if I'm going to drink one.
Right.
But it would be hard for me to swallow this whole 22-ouncer. This is really good, man. I'm just not telling you that. Guys, for real, it's great. I could drink many of these.
So when I went up there, and I said, okay, man, we'll do this one. But I thought, man, it's going to take 7 or 8 times to go through this, brewing process to get the right beer. So where are you guys at?
So I've gone to the brewery. We've taste tested a bunch of different beers. I've narrowed it down to the beer that I like, that we think... Not just that I like, but everybody's really going to like. It's kind of like a compromise, like a marriage. It's a good compromise, right? But so we went, and so now we're just deciding if we want to throw what's really getting big, popular now is beers with a little of a fruit tint in it. Not too much. You get like grapefruit IPAs that and stuff. But those are good. It's just got a little bit. So we're thinking maybe we might call it Gory Bomb because my grandfather – Gory made the Gory Special, and I turned that into the Gory Bomb. I don't want it to be too much of a wrestling beer, But we're still kicking it around, so we might throw a little hint of an orange, something like that, in there. We're not sure yet. We're gonna play with it a little bit. So that's where we're at. We're very close. Like, I could just pick that beer as the way it is now because it's awesome, and then we'd just sign some on the dotted line, basically.
Don't try to put 10 pounds of shit in a 5 pound bag.
Like a match?
Yeah.
How many times you said that,
It's going on more and more and more as we continue to watch the business evolve. Hey, man, you were talking about Gory, and we were walking down the sidewalk to get these beers out of the crib. Dude, what kind of pressure was it coming from just y'all? The Guerrero family is one of the most famous wrestling families in the history of the business. Was there any pressure on you? Because I know that you would wrestle Eddie, during intermission, a lot of shows way back in the day. And Eddie actually went to college. Did you go to college? Because I'm asking you, how did you know that this was what you wanted to do? Everybody else is doing it in your family.
So the first part of the question, there was some pressure for sure. As a kid, no. We had a wrestling ring in the backyard. I grew up with my grandfather's promotion. We've sold tickets, sold popcorn, sold 8x10s, set up the ring, traveled. To us, it was fun. This was what we did. It was great. There was me and Eddie loved wrestling. We loved it. That's all we had a wrestling ring in the backyard. We learned how to walk in a wrestling ring. Then the summer before my freshman year, me and Eddie must have been a junior, going to his junior year, maybe it was senior year. We traveled, my uncle Hector and my father were tag team for Dusty at Florida Championship Wrestling, FCW. So we've traveled for the summer, the entire summer we spent with those guys. And man, when I tell you, we loved wrestling before. After spending, they took us on the road. They took us to the bars. They did everything. We really loved wrestling after that. We were like, wow, this is exactly what we want to do. Eddie lost his virginity on that trip. Man, it was, every little town back in the day, you know, we'd go like Monday would be Tampa, Tuesday would be Orlando, whatever. I'm getting the dates wrong, but Wednesday, the days wrong. Wednesday was West Palm Beach, you know, they do, you know, TV somewhere. Then we do Miami, we do somewhere else. So, you know, he and I would travel everywhere. We'd have our little rats in every little city, you know, and I had my little 12-year-old, 14-year-old rats and like meeting them. Hey, how you doing? And you know, I'd make out with the one in every little place. I was like, wow, this is what it's like, you know. And then, you know, we'd go in the bars, man. We'd travel in this place, and if I had to pull over to take a piss, you know, Mike Davis would look at me and say, nah, we don't do that. Piss in the water bottle, I mean the Gatorade bottle, kid. They'd never stop to eat afterwards. We'd drunk because we had 300-mile drive back. So we'd stop at the 7-Eleven or the gas station, and we'd get beef jerky and a hot dog and a bunch of beer, and we'd get the Gatorades and just start driving, man. We fell in love with it, man. It was pretty awesome. And the one time, so Kendall Windham was there too. So Kendall was only, Eddie was maybe 16. Kendall was 17, but Kendall was 6'5" already. He was a big kid, so he could buy beer. So when my dad and my Uncle Hector would go do a shot for Bill Watts, they'd fly to Houston. This is when we were there, and they'd leave us there for a day or two. So me and Eddie would be like, what are we going to do? Like, all right, well, let's call Kendall up. So Kendall would come over and go buy us a beer. We'd be, you know, looking through the medicine cabinet and find a little and you know, oh man, we were like on our own. It was like, this is what it's like to be wrestlers. Yes, we couldn't wait. So, you know, that the pressure, there was no pressure there. Then once I became a wrestler, getting in the door was easy. People say, oh, you're a girl, come on in. Well, shoot, I'd only been wrestling a year. You know, I mean, I probably had 20 matches. Next, you know, I'm in WCW. I'm like, really? And then they're comparing me to Eddie, who they're comparing to my father, who they're comparing to my grandfather, and it's tough. That's really tough. But it was like I learned on the job, and it was a lot of sink or swim for sure. And you know, you're getting beat up a lot, and you get beat up so much that you get tired of being beat up, and then you start fighting back. And so my teachers was Benoit, Eddie, Malenko, Finley, Regal. Then we had the next.
Jeez, yeah, like a who's who of people that can.
Yeah,
train
then
you.
Yeah, then we had. I mean, those guys would beat me up every single night. Then we'd have the next generation that was like, we'd have like the Arns and the Hennings and those guys, like the Rudes and those guys. Then we'd go to the Arns and the Flares and stuff. And then after that, we'd still have other guys up, like Dickie Slater and those guys, all those guys. I was working with these guys, like four generations of people. Colonel Parker was there and telling us all the old stories. And there was, you know, I had Booker T, and all the locker room was incredible back then. We just missed you. You had just taken off, right? I think when I first started there, you hadn't hit it hot. You weren't, I think you were still the ringmaster.
Yeah.
Or maybe you were just killing an ECW. One of the two. And man, what a time to be. We're just talking to Booker T about this the other day. What a time to be wrestling. So anyways, we get wrestling, and first I'd have to pay for a lot of my dad's mistakes from a lot of the guys that, you know, they wronged. You know, he'd get me in the ring, and they'd be like, certain guys like Scott Hall, I love him to death, but he lit me up real good. And that boy's got some hard chops, and he's known for that. Man, he chopped me so hard. He literally, like, not just welted my chest, but cut my chest with his hand. And I was, man, afterwards, I was pissed. My Uncle Hector looked at me and goes, yeah, welcome to the business, son. He goes, we do that every night. And I was like, wow, I didn't know it hurt so much. But then after that, man, you get your butt kicked enough, and you're like, well, then nothing hurts anymore.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
You own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com. But so then you're third generation.
Mm-hmm. Third generation on both sides. My grandmother met my grandfather because she went to see her brother wrestle and then saw my grandfather and fell in love with him. And all of his brothers were wrestlers, and his brother's kids and his kids were wrestlers. So on both sides of the family, there's you know, 25 wrestlers in a family.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
This seems to be my observation, that a lot of second-generation guys, or third-generation, there's not as many second-generation guys, in most cases, just seem to absorb the business or have a better understanding of it, or they're more natural to it because they've been around it so much and they've just been observing it if they haven't been in a ring, but just being around it and understanding the dynamics of it.
I see that for sure. Now, there's a lot of second and third generation wrestlers that are out of jobs that never made it. You
Correct.
See a lot of those guys. Me and Fit Finlay, I use Fit Finlay a lot as a example because he's a third generation wrestler.
Dude, he takes the business. You and I take it serious.
Yeah.
I would venture to say he's probably more serious. And then, dude, I'm about as hardcore as you can get, but he's definitely serious about the business. It's
We talked about it a lot, man. It's real to us. It's not just the work. It's in the ring. It's real. I remember my dad, when I was a kid, telling me, God, I feel the pain, man. When he was kicking my leg, I feel that pain. And I'd be the same way. I'd be in the back after selling my leg in a match, and I'm still limping. And they're going, why are you limping? I'm like, I'm okay. Never mind. I'll keep selling it. So me and Fit Finlay were talking, and Dave was like, sometimes there's things that I know in the business, and I don't know how I know them. I just know them. And there's a reason that when I went to Lucha Underground, so you didn't know that I'm a producer on Lucha Underground.
Yeah.
So when I went there, and they didn't really know wrestling, and all of a sudden I'm telling the camera guys how to film this. Now, this is all from watching WWE and watching Vince and Kevin Dunn and all those guys do their stuff. And I was a very quick learner by watching. I was telling the camera guys how to film this, the director how to direct it, the seamstress how to sew the costumes, the tights, so that, you know, you can't have a spike on the knee because you're gonna kill somebody, you know, and then your ring is set up wrong, all these different things, your mats are wrong, you only have 4-foot mats, and like, you know, the set designer was going, well, that's all we have for a budget. And I'm like, look, I get it, that's all we have for a budget, but we're flying over those, and you're going to crack somebody's head open real fast. The show producer, Eric Van Wagner, who you know,
yes,
walks by me and goes, what's up, Chavo? And I said, look, our mats are too small. He's like, why? And I explained to him, and he goes, okay, order mats now. And it was like right there, because he understood that these guys are going to kill themselves. And before an indie show, when they got nobody to sue, it's fine. But when you got Mark Burnett to sue, you know, they're going to come after it, you know.
That's the thing I liked about working with Eric Van Wagenen on Tough Enough. Dude, we'd have a little conversation.
He loves you.
And it was just, you know, we went out and did it. There wasn't no script, wasn't no paper, just we talked about it, and then they started filming it.
Right.
He acclimated to the business very quickly, and he has a love for it and an appreciation for it and respect for it. So, like, when you say, hey, man, we need this, you know, there's no hesitation. And, you know, let's go get the other mat so these guys don't kill themselves.
Period.
Dude, you guys are doing some crazy-ass shit over there. I mean, some of that high-flying stuff, I know some of it's camera angles, but, yeah, to a degree, yeah. But some of that stuff that the guys were jumping off of is very spectacular.
Our first season. So when I came on, you know, nobody really knew what we were, not that we were doing, but we all had an idea of what we wanted to do. And what the final product came out, I just say the stars aligned, because that product, it changed the game a little bit. We did our own thing. WWE is the Coca-Cola of wrestling. If anybody else comes out and makes another cola, you're just an RC cola. You're a knockoff. That's all you are. And we've seen it time and time again. Everybody trying to copy them, right? And they're doing something right because everybody's trying to copy them. So then we come in, and Mark Burnett is notorious for saying, hey, I would rather fail being original than succeed being the same. So that's what he did. And when we came in, we were still filming the first season. I saw the first episode. I got to see a preview of it. I was blown away. I was blown away. Just the way that the angles are, they come in with the shots of the helicopter coming into the city, and they come into a scene, and then it morphs into the ring. I was like, wow, I've never seen this before. Usually it's the production trying to keep up with the wrestlers. But this time it was the wrestlers having to keep up with production. And I pulled the wrestlers aside and said, guys, come here. We need to step up our game, because this is a new product. You've never seen this before. So then I got guys like Pentagon, Phoenix, Prince Puma, now Willie Mack and Mil Muertes, Ricky Banderas, Drago, all these guys that have never, the world has, Mexico's seen them, but the world's never seen these guys. So, and I'm pulling these guys have been on TV sometimes for 10 years over there. I'm pulling them aside and go, look, this is all Vince stuff. Look at that camera right there. This is your moneymaker. Look at your face. If you're looking side to side, that camera's chasing you. You can't stop and make sure that camera focuses on your face. They're like, oh, Chavo, they never told us this before. I said, no one's told you this before? They said, no. And I said, okay, just now grab a hold. I don't care if it's taking too long. You just stop and wait and sit on it. I don't care if they're quiet. Now, our believers are really, they're always constantly going. But I don't care if they're quiet. Just wait. Stop. And they're like, nobody's told us this before. And I said, well, this is how you do it. This is what I've learned. This is how I was taught. And I was taught by the best in the business. So it's worked for a long time. They went out and did it. And look what they are doing now. This, like you were talking about Pentagon and Phoenix before. Those guys are, how great are those guys?
Oh, those guys are awesome. Those are my favorite gimmicks as well. So when you were at WCW, you were paying attention to the camera setups. And when you got to WWE, you were really paying attention to a lot of people don't get that because I didn't. I was there to work, and I didn't give a shit where the cameras were. I just worked, and I was just worried about me. You were a little bit of level ahead of me, though, on that curve.
Yes and no, man. You know what? There's... This is an art form. Wrestling is an art form. I tell people that all the time. They think we just go in there and wrestle. It's an art form to learn this business. And now I grew up, I'm 85 years, wrestling has fed my family. I grew up with a wrestling ring in the backyard, third generation on both sides. And it really, when I tell you, it took me 5 years before I really knew what was going on. That's the truth. 5 years of being at the highest level, of being at WCW. Now, there were times when I was wrestling in there and I'd get out of the ring and it's like, oh, who was my ref again? I don't even remember who my ref was because I was so like awestruck. But there was one time I was in the ring and I remember hitting, the guy was on a turnbuckle and I hit him, boom, and I heard this roar like, ah, and I went, wait a minute, what was that? And I stopped and I hit him again, boom, and I went, oh, that's what they're talking about. The crowd, learning how to work these people. I was like, that's what they're talking about. I didn't know. I was like, oh, there it is. But after that, it took me another 5 years. So I'm talking 10 years in this business until, and this is not just because we're on this episode. It took me 10 years in the business till I had Ric Flair and I had you telling me, hey, going out of your way to go, hey, excellent match. It took me a long time. One time it was the Survivor Series. Me and Rey Mysterio went and tore it down like me and Ray do. And as I came back, you pulled me aside and you put your hand out. You said, excellent match. And I said, well, now I've made it. But when Ric Flair was telling me, Chavito, hey, great match, kid. I was like, all right, now we've arrived. And then you even been given better than that, you know?
But you agree. I agree with you because that 5 year mark is kind of a, you know, it's absolutely there, but it's between the 5 and 10 and it's an average of 10 before I think, you know, guys have flipped back and forth, baby face to heel baby or whatever. But that 10 year mark is kind of, dude, at 10 years, you should know your shit inside and out. You're still going to always have more to learn.
You never
stop learning. You know, if you are piss poor at 10 years, if you're piss poor at 10 years, you're probably not cut out for this business.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you are, you should be outstanding by that point. And Macho Man's a classic example of that because I don't know how long he worked. Shoot, what territory he worked before he got to USWA, but he was a Macho Man down there. But
was he? Okay.
When Vince picked him up, I mean, he'd already been in a ring damn near 10 years, and boy, all of a sudden he gets on WWF TV or New York TV with Vince and blows up because he knew how to work like a bastard.
But that's how the business is. It's changed because you didn't make it to WWE, WWF, until you were 10 or 15 years in. You didn't even make it there. That you were at the pinnacle of your career. Now, and nothing, I'm not talking nothing, just saying that sometimes, because I respect those guys, and I'm always, like I said before with you in the other room, that I'm for the wrestlers, man. I'm always for the wrestlers. I want these guys to just thrive, and I want these guys to be taken care of, you know, from all the stuff that we've gone through. But it almost seems like you start your career there now, and then you go somewhere else. You start in there like, you know, you go down to NXT or you get trained, you're a bodybuilder or a football player or whatever you are, and then you get trained for a couple of years, and then you make it to the big time, and you stay there for a couple of years, and then you leave. It almost seems like that's the way it's happening. But so there's something, we're missing a step. And thank God that that indie wrestling, there was a lot of times that these guys, I'll say Ricochet, Prince Puma, who, when I got him in Lucha Underground, I was like, how come he hasn't been picked up before? And they're like, oh, well, they passed on him. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? Willie Mack, Brian Cage, all these guys. I'm like, what do you mean they passed on these guys? I'm like, but you know, when you're up there, you always think, well, they got rid of this guy, but they kept this guy. Like, why did that happen? I was always a huge fan of, A-Train, Prince Albert, Baldo. When they let him go and he went to
New Japan.
New Japan. I was like, oh yeah, okay. There's a 320 pounder who can work, who doesn't mind putting people over and doing business. And yeah, we'll go ahead and let him go. And I was like, well, how could you let this guy go? That guy's golden. Like that's who you build your company around.
But it's interesting. You know, when I watch Lucha Underground, I watch WWE, man, you know, I love WWE.
Absolutely.
But, you know, just because they have, you know, two live shows,
yeah,
5 hours of programming right there,
that's tough.
3 hours Raw, 2 hours SmackDown, do they need talent? And, you know, a lot of their people have, you know, that are, you know, making their in-ring debuts are not a lot of them, but a few of them.
They're not ready yet.
Two, three, and 4 years, yeah, or even some even sooner than that. And dude, when you get your number called, it's like, you know, when I got called up from USWA and went to WCW, and I'm working with beautiful Bob Eaton, one of my favorites of all time. And
bro,
so underrated and unappreciated. If you don't know anything about Bob Eaton, you don't know shit about wrestling.
That's right.
I couldn't lace his boots, so I took a TV title off of him. So, you know, what I say, hey, man, I don't think I should beat Bob Eaton, you know, because I'm not good enough. So what are these kids supposed to say?
Yeah.
You know, hey, they're giving you a push, so you take that opportunity.
You take what you got because you don't
get it. Green is green, you know, so you got to do what you got to do.
Absolutely.
But, you know, when you watch that Lucha Underground stuff, like that Mil Muertes, I don't know how long he's been, but, man, I love that guy's work. He's aggressive, mean.
I got him, and he'll tell you. So Ricky Banderas has wrestled for a long time. From Puerto Rico, wrestled in Mexico as El Macias and stuff. And I wrestled him before Lucha Underground was even a thought. When we got him over here and they put that gimmick on him, I looked at him and I saw his first match. And I looked at him and said, no, come here. I go, bro, you do what you want. This is my opinion. But you are, and I always bring up Taker and Kane, because I go, you're a monster. You're not real. You can't kill you. Your name is Mil Muertes. You're man of a thousand deaths. They can't kill you. So don't put a rest hold on somebody. Don't grab a hold. Just beat them up. I see you. When I see your mouth open up, I see bats fly out of your mouth. And he's like, oh, wow, I love that, Chavo. Okay, okay. So every time he'd come to me, like, how was that? And I said, more. Kill him. Kill him. Apologize later. Kill him. And they're like, okay, okay, okay. We're doing business, right? You're building, doing business. You're building company. And then and every time I see the guy, he hugs me and kisses me. He goes, Chavo, you made me. You made me. Now, I didn't. I just gave him advice that I learned from other people.
But, dude, that's the thing. You got to have that advice handed to you or, you know, someone to solicit or offer it to you. Man, I came in just riding down the road in all the cars that I've been in.
Yeah.
You know, with the veterans, man, I'd be, you know, picking their brain, whether it's Gorgeous Gary Young or Maniac Matt Bourne or all these other guys or Danny Davis down there. Man, why'd you do this when you did it? Well, hell, Steve, here's why. And, you know, it's stuff like that or riding down the road with Skandar Akbar and Bronco Lubitsch, your referee.
Bronco Lubitsch, yeah.
Riding in the back of a Delta 88 with Velour Interior. And, you know, just listen to those old
that's
guys
right.
just
that's
tell
right.
stories. And that's all right. of a sudden you start absorbing this shit. And it's like just you're a sponge, a dry-ass sponge. And all of a sudden they just keep pouring water and you just absorb it all. But it's those guys. And that's always – I always just think it's, you know, it's – as the road that I've been down, anytime I get
Klondike
a chance.
Bill. Remember Klondike Bill?
Do?
Klondike Bill. Remember Klondike
Bill?
Oh,
yeah, absolutely. On the ring crew at WCW. But all those guys, you know, if you don't pass down that knowledge, you know, the next generation can't learn from you. And that's what you got to do to keep the business going strong, in my opinion.
I agree. Hey, that's – and I tell a lot of guys now, like my dad and those guys, and your time, they were very stingy with the business. They didn't want to give you the business because you take their spot. They were like, oh, we can't help you. We can't – you figure it out for yourself, kid. We'll give you a little bit. We won't give you all of it. But nowadays, it's a dying art. So we want to give as much as we can to these guys because it's going to be lost if we don't. Now, wrestling evolves. It's like any kind of business. It evolves. If you don't evolve with it, it'll pass you by. I always bring up like Madonna, by the way. So I was listening. It was on the radio the other day and my brother-in-law was going, you like Madonna? I said, well, I don't really have her music, but I respect Madonna because she's kept herself in the, in, as a performer, as an entertainer in the limelight, kept herself relevant for 35 years or whatever it is. And that's very hard to do. She constantly changed and evolved. And in wrestling, if you don't change and evolve, the wrestling will pass you by. If you keep doing the same stuff, if they're not buying it, they don't buy it. Sometimes right. they buy it and you're fine. You just keep going. But sometimes, I mean, I use Terry Funk. He did his first moonsault at 43 years old. Not saying that you got to do a moonsault, but you just evolve. You got to evolve. And if you don't, you don't. That's the thing that we're talking about with, you know, grab hold or what do you say, 10 pounds of shit in a 6-pound bag or whatever it is, whatever that saying was. But the business has evolved a little bit. Every match can't be like that, but there's room for some of the matches to be like that. I remember Ricochet, we're talking about him and the other kid from New Japan, that's the English kid that
Will Ospreay.
Ospreay. They had that match and it got praise and it got a lot of criticism, right? Well, first of all, I can't do any of that stuff. And we were one of the top cruiserweights back in the day, right? Me and Mary Mysterio look at each other and go, oh my God, we can't do any of this stuff anymore like these guys could. And we never could think about that stuff. But I saw that match and I was like, wow, that's awesome. Would I have done that match? I couldn't do that match. I'd do it a little bit differently, but it, not that it was wrong. It was just different. The business has evolved.
But it was their interpretation and their skill set that they put out there.
It was incredible. So Jeff Farmer, who used to be the NWO Sting, Jeff Farmer Cobra, he was like in WCW. I remember he was great, real cool guy, great guy. But when I first got to WCW, he pulled me aside and he says, the first time Eddie and Chris Benoit worked in WCW, the locker room had never seen that. So they did this, they did about an 8-minute match. They got done and everybody was like, they walked through and everybody was like, well, did you guys rehearse that for like 3 months or what? I'm like, no, we just went out and called it. What do you mean you called it? Well, we know each other pretty well. We just sit there like, I never done it. And Terry Taylor kicks the door down and goes, that's how you work, guys. That's how you do it. And they said the business changed right when that happened. Literally when I got to WCW and all the cruiserweights were doing stuff, I remember seeing Kane do a hurricanrana or a head scissors, and I was like, okay, well, now this business has definitely changed for sure, you know. Not that he's doing those all the time, but I saw him do one with a big guy. I don't know if it was Midian or somebody, you know, somebody like that. And he did one. I was like, wow, it's changed.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Support for this podcast comes from Pluto TV. Need an escape? Drop into Pluto TV for a world of free TV. Stream hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and shows all for free. Yeah, free. No subscriptions, no fees. Imagine 24/7 channels of Narcos, CSI, Star Trek, Survivor, and everything else from hit movies to binge-worthy TV shows. The latest news, live sports, comedy, and more. What are you waiting for? Download the free Pluto TV app for Android, iPhone, Roku, and Fire TV and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Hey, man, tell me about the rings you grew up with back when you was a kid.
Hard, man. The ring we had in the backyard was when I was a kid, it was 40 years old. So I don't know how old it is now. I mean, well,
but was it just like with a 16-footer, 18-footer?
I mean, no, it was probably a 20-footer. The one at the Olympic Auditorium used to be a 24-footer.
Are you kidding me?
No kidding. If you look at it, back at the Olympic Auditorium here, now where my dad first started, that's why we're here in California, because my dad first started wrestling for Mike LaBelle at the WWA, I believe it was called. It was like NWA Hollywood, basically. It was like Freddie Blassie and John Tolos and very, very young Roddy Piper and Victor Rivera. I could go on and on. But that was a 24-footer back and forth. They said they'd get so blown up going back and forth. And they said, gosh, dang, are you kidding me? Like, really? Our rings, we had a few different rings. So my grandfather had like three different rings. He had the portable 16-footer. And then he had the one in the backyard was like a 20-footer. You know, that's about, you know, pretty standard, 18, 20.
That's
foot.
What WWE's using. We 20. Use 18 foot in WCW.
Yeah, 18 and then 20. Yeah, right. That's kind of the standard in it because you can transport it, but you can work in it actually. You know, 16 footers are too small sometimes. If you know tag a 16 footer, forget it. You just can't even.
Think about the 16 footers. Let me jump in here. We used to work those tent shows when I first went to WWE. Back in 95 and 96, and I was working with Aldo Montoya, PJ Polacco, whatever gimmick he was working at the time. And man, the thing about the 16 footers was they're so small. You got to really work hard to blow up in a 16 footer. You got to really be out of shape to blow out in a 16 footer because, you know, you send somebody into a reversal, you're already at the damn ropes.
Step or two,
and so it's just, and plus, they're not like a trampoline because I hate when people compare a ring to a trampoline, but they just got that. The whole square.
Yeah, the sweet spot. The sweet spot.
Sweet spot. Yeah. The whole ring is a sweet spot. Because in an 18 footer and a 20 footer, you damn sure want to find a sweet spot. But in a 16 footer, the whole thing is.
Yeah.
So those things were just a blast to work in. Plus the acoustics. I don't know, but between the iron, the wood, and everything,
those tent shows and like the Hamptons and all those, remember those places?
Cape Cod.
I remember I was, that's a good story. We were in wrestling in Mexico somewhere. I think it was Tijuana, and it was me, Edge, and Randy Orton against Rey Mysterio and DX, who was, Sean and Hunter. So we wrestled in there. Me and Rey had the big angle. So what was cool is that Hunter comes to me and goes, "Hey, do you mind if we all put our finish on you and beat you?" I'm like, "No." I'm like, "Wait a minute. It took three of you guys maybe?" "Yeah, absolutely. Great." But nobody told me that it was a 16 footer. So when I got in the ring, I was like, "Okay, first of all, I'm in the ring with Triple H and, you know, I don't care where you're at. You're like, okay, all right, gotta bring my game up a little bit here, right?" And I'm looking around and like, something's off in the ring. And I see guys get in the ring doing stuff and I'm like, "What's off? Why is this?" I'm looking around the crowd. I'm like, "What is different about this?" And then I got in the ring and, somebody shot me off and I hit the rope and all of a sudden, I ate an elbow really hard because I mean, as soon as I turned around, the elbow was there. Boom. And I went, "Oh, it's a small ring." That's what's different about this thing. I said, okay, then I adjusted it, but I kind of was like, no one told me. And I was like, sometimes you see something right in your face and sometimes you don't see it. And I just didn't see it. And I was like, "Oh, that's what it is." But that was a good
dude. I can only imagine working in a 24 footer because when you're adding 4 feet to the WWE size ring,
can you imagine that?
No, I can't.
Grab a hold. Grab a hold. No, I'm serious. It was a 24 footer, man. This ring was massive. 4 feet on each side. That's 8 feet. And you're running 8 more feet over a 10 to 25 minute period, you know? And back then, you know, you're doing that time. They didn't have 18 matches in the show. Man, and then the apron, even the apron was bigger too, you know? So you look at that ring. Ring's in a lot of movies too, because they always film a bunch of stuff all over the Olympic Auditorium. You always see that Richmond 95171, that sign in the background. And you see that ring's in a lot of movies, like Bad News Bears movies. All these movies back, the one and only back in the day with Henry Winkler, that was filmed.
See, the 24 foot ring would be great for a tag match because if there's one thing it really chaps my ass is when someone's going for the tag and the heels let them get too close and a baby or the heels got an alligator arm over there or if they got the tag rope, you know, they're hanging on to the right there by the turnbuckle instead of being extended with the rope and reaching out to make it a shoot.
Alligator arms.
So the alligator arms just T-Rex. Really, don't get me wrong. I've done my share of alligator arms in the past, but I just hate to see it from a technical aspect of the business.
Me and Eddie, when we were tagging up as Los Guerreros, we hated that, man. We hated that. We would say, "Hey, we tell the guys, challenge them. If you can tag. It's our fault." And we'd have, like, "We'll buy you drinks tonight." All right. We'd have, like, Spike Dudley running to try to tag. We'd, like, try to cut them off and stuff. But we would keep everybody on our side of the ring. Like, not even our side, our corner. We wouldn't even turn our backs to them because if we did, they'd run and tag. We'd just challenge them. "If you can tag, man. It's our fault." So it was real in a sense like that, you know?
But that's smart to do that because, I mean, like, you know, the business will work, but, you know, it's like,
it's a work, but it's not a work.
But the bottom line, dude, you gotta feel.
If you and you'll tell me, you'll know this. If you don't believe it, they don't believe it.
Exactly.
When you were doing your, you know, when you were stone cold in the heyday and you against, you know, Vince and all that stuff you're doing back in the day, you looking in the eye, you believed it. You wanted to kick his ass. It came off that way. We could see it. And I'm the same way. When I get in the ring, I believe I'm looking at you. I'm like, all right, I'm going to kick your ass. Let's do this. Because I always equate, and I use this example a lot when I'm teaching younger guys. I say, when you're in a bar fight, we've both been in a million bar fights, and all of a sudden you look at somebody, and if I'm looking around his eye and he looks away, I go, oh, I got him. As soon as he looks away or looks down, I go, I got him. And I'll turn it up. But when I look at him and he goes, yeah, come on. I go, ah, shit, man. Now I got to go. Like, he's calling my bluff, man. Like, oh, okay. But that's the way it is in the ring. He believes it because he knows that I'm laser throughing him. And that's the way it is in the ring. In the ring, if I don't believe it, those fans don't believe it. If I don't believe that I'm going to beat the crap out of this guy or I'm getting my butt kicked, I'm running away and I'm trying to make that tag, then it doesn't matter. So I tell the guys, if you're going to let me tag, well, then I'm going to tag. I'm not going to sit there and go, oh, because then you sacrifice the integrity of the match. Don't ever sacrifice the integrity of the match. There's a couple more examples I use. So one example is I equate wrestling to this one. I'm doing like a seminar and teaching people. It's like magic. It's like Chris Angel. Christian, we all know magic's an illusion. Just like wrestling, it's entertainment. But just because magic's an illusion, as soon as Chris Angel starts floating, you go, whoa, he's floating. How's he doing that? Whoa, what's going on? How's he doing that? But when you see the string, you go, okay, change the channel. He's insulting my intelligence now. So I tell the wrestlers, don't ever let him see the string. Don't ever let him see that wrestling punch. Don't ever let him see, a hold put on wrong, because then they see the string. Or don't ever can't make the tag, because then they see that string and then they change the channel. Because the biggest form of flattery is they want to lose themselves in your match. They want it to suspension of belief, suspend their belief. So they want to, but if you don't let them, then they can't. So as soon as they're like, unless they're, 5 years or 10 years old, but even that, I mean, when I was a kid at the Lick Auditorium, I'd ask my dad, hey, how come when they shoot you to the rope, you don't stop? He goes, what do you mean? I go, well, shoot me the rope. We're in the ring. I'm 10 years old. He shoots me in and I kind of stop. And he shot me and he went for it. And I slowed down and I go, how come you don't do that? And he goes, well, it's wrestling. We don't do that. And I went, okay. But I'm 10 years old thinking that. A 25-year-old man's going to think, come on, let's not insult their intelligence. Let's not sacrifice that integrity of that match. So take pride in your job. Take all you young guys, take pride in your business. Take pride in your work and make them question whether this is a work or not. That's where you get them.
Hey, man, you're 47. You've been in the business, what, 22 years?
Probably.
Probably more than
that. I don't even know anymore.
What's worse, you've been hurt in the ring?
Well, I'm just getting over a bicep tear right here. Look at this. Boom. My arm's not straightening like yours all of a sudden.
What happened?
WrestleMania weekend, we're all in New Orleans, and we had a Lucha Underground versus Impact Wrestling, TNA Impact. I was agenting the show, for Lucha Underground, and I came in there, and then they say, hey, can you wrestle? Yeah, sure. Sure enough, some guy jumped out. I'm trying to protect him, and it just popped off. Just a fluke, just popped off. So, worst injury. Okay, so, we've all been injured a lot, broken eye orbits, and I tore this one in 03, this bicep. The worst injury was when I got knocked out in the ring. Billy Kidman did a shooting star press in the ring, Fresno, California, landed right on my head, and he almost killed me because my brain was bleeding. I woke up in the hospital, my wife's next to me, and she's like, I'm like, why are you here? And she's like, well, you had brain bleeding and they were going to cut your head open if it didn't stop to relieve the pressure. So that was probably the worst. I didn't work for about 4 months. I kind of had to learn how to rewrite and stuff a little bit, but it is what it is.
What'd Billy say to you?
He felt really bad, but what was really cool is that he was still married to Tori Wilson at the time. So I was like, well, okay, you try to kill me, so I'm going to go hit on your girlfriend, on your wife for a while. I go, what's he going to say? You almost killed me. You're going to kill me again?
Whatever happened to that guy? Good looking guy, good worker. I know he's producing for a while.
Kidman is, he's the timekeeper. He took over Briscoe's job.
Okay.
Yeah, Jerry Briscoe. He's the
in WWE.
Yes, he's the main timekeeper in WWE. Yeah, he's gorilla position all the time, man. He's got a good little spot over there. Yeah, good guy, good worker. He was awesome, man. He was a lot of fun. We broke in together,
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
You own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to Geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit Geico.com today. That's Geico.com. How do you feel as far as the pain level goes? Like, man, I talked to Tommy Rogers before he died.
Yeah, a couple years ago. What a great wrestler.
Man, oh, dude, those guys were on fire. Yeah. Fantastics. I was talking to him, and I said, Steve. He said, Steve. He goes, on a 10 out of 10, I'm a 10. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, dude, are you that bad off? And he's telling about eating Perks. I mean, he wasn't.
Oh, wow.
He wasn't on just, you know, taking them for the hell of it.
Sure.
Because he was hooked on them.
Sure.
He was taking them for a shoot because that's how much pain he was in. So, you know, like right now, as I sit here before you doing this podcast, you know, everybody thinks I'm just beat to shreds.
Yeah.
And I am. But I don't, on a 1 to 10, I'm not even a 1 on a daily basis.
Yeah, you're
every now and then you have those shitty days.
Sure.
But men are few and far between.
Yeah.
So how about you with all the shit you did?
I actually feel good, man. What saved us is that we're not 6'8", 300 pounds. Your bones and your ligaments, mine and yours, Big Show's, they're all the same strength. They're just bone and ligaments. I don't have 300 pounds pounding all that all the time. So I was able, we were able to get away from it pretty good. You know, everybody in the family is, you know, look back here and there, knees here and there, but for the most part, we're all okay, you know, and I'm one of those guys that I took care of my body. I really iced all the time. I went from the
you were ahead of your time.
Yeah, I did the Dallas.
Nobody was doing it. Well, DDP.
I did the DDP, school of self-help. We used to joke that in WCW, his merchandise would have been a ice bag with DDP on it because he'd be on the, on the plane. And I love DDP to death, but he'd be on the plane with like 18 ice packs on him and tell him the flight attendant, hey, can you get me more ice? And she's like, you know, they only have so much ice on a plane, right? And he's like, she's like, son of a bitch. This guy really is like, fill all these ice packs up.
It's like, dude, this guy's got some nerve asking you, hey, can you go give me some ice? And he's got an ice pack on every joint on his body. And I used to tell him because it was me and Mick Foley rooming with him. He'd walk around the room naked with all these ice packs on him.
He was like 80 years old back then. Yeah. he'd lie and say he was 45, but he was like 80.
I'd have a bunch of beer. I'd have a bunch of ice from a beer, but all the damn ice would be in, you know, in baggies on it, on his damn joints. Yeah. So I'd just put a beer on his arm and then go get when I needed it.
Exactly.
So you feel pretty good.
I feel good, man. I'm thank God, man. I'm still, I don't wake up in pain. Now there's days, like you said, there's days for sure, you know, but you know, it is what it is. And you know, age has a lot to do with it too. You know, you don't heal as fast. Like this bicep is taking a lot longer.
What are you doing with your workouts now? I mean, because you're staying active, you look good. I mean, you're obviously still in the gym.
So I just started working out again. I was on the margarita diet. The margarita diet.
Talking about Brumsco Ranch margaritas.
No, I was training hard. And right before I got hurt, I was probably the best I ever looked, man. I was jacked. I was veiny. I felt awesome. And then you got hurt. And so I started sitting on the couch for a little bit. And, you know, and I like to eat. So we're eating, hanging out. So I just kind of started training again probably the last 2 weeks, you know. So I feel good, you know. I mean, when I go in the ring, I'm going to go to the gym. I train hard. I train smart though. I don't train real heavy. I just get in there. I kill it. I'm in there for about 45 minutes to an hour and I get out. And I'm there about 5 days a week. Just boom, I hit it.
You're in a body part every 5 days or what?
I play off how I feel. You know what I mean? Sometimes I'll do a back and buys. If I only got a little time, I just hit shoulders real quick, you know. It just depends. I'm one of those guys that's lucky that I don't have to do a lot of legs because they just grow faster. And you're probably the same way, right?
Yeah.
They grow a lot faster than the rest of my body. So I'm kind of like, that takes a whole body part that I don't have to do all the time, you know? So, you know, I'm a chest and shoulders guy, and then I'll do arms one day. And then, you know, if I get real, you know, enthusiastic, I'll throw some abs in there, you know, but back for sure, you know.
So what are you doing with your rep range?
I don't go less than 4. I don't have like a 1 rep maximum. I'm not trying to gain size or strength anymore. I'm usually I superset everything. I try to get a 10 rep range. If I can hit more, then I'll hit more. But I'm usually about a, you know, 10. I do everything to failure the way it goes, but it's usually about 10 reps. Until I can't do it, I'll stop, drop the weight, and hit it again. I don't have to do too much anymore. So as a kid, I didn't have to do a lot of cardio. Now I have to do more cardio. But, it was hard for me to gain weight back then. Now I keep my size, no problem. So at least like if I'm doing chest, I'll blow it out with a bunch of push-ups first and get my chest activated. And then whatever I'm doing, it's just repping it. It's pumping out. If I'm doing back, I'll grab like a 65-pounder and rep, you know, 20 on one side, like bent over rows, 20 on one side, 20 on the other, 15, 15, 10, 12, 12, 12, 10, 10. And after that, man, now it's like I'm jacked, I'm pumped. And now I'll do another 12 exercises, but everything is just, I'm done. I'm out.
That's kind of what I'm doing. Like, as far as my pressing movements, I'll start off, you know, like on bench with a buck 35, but I'll do probably five sets, but I'll do them to failures.
Right.
So then when I start going down to get my fives in or my eights and my fives, I've pre-exhausted everything. Yeah. So the ultimate weight is not that much, but it feels like a lot.
You're not trying to gain size anymore. It's different.
Yeah, I'm trying to train smart. I mean, because I got two blown rotator cuffs. I had them fixed, but you know, they're not the same. This arm doesn't straighten out. It's all the same bullshit, but I try to kind of, you know, get everything tired before, you know, I tax it with, again, it's not heavy, but it feels heavy to me at the time.
It's the way of life. We continually just hit it all the time. I don't ever miss more than a day or two. Even on vacation, I feel bad if I'm not doing squats or doing something. You know what I mean? If after like, man, 2 days, today's the third day. Okay, I got to do something. I got to break a little bit of a sweat because that way I can drink more beer and I can eat more. But, I just feel like I'm just like, that's just my routine, man. I got to get a little sweat in there. I got to do something, you know?
Hey, man, last time you competed in, the ring, was that for Lucha Underground? I was just watching you versus, Ray. In the, Loser Leaves Lucha match. Yeah. And that was from, I think, 16.
Yeah.
But are you still actively in the ring?
Yeah, you know, so besides Lucha Underground, I'm doing GLOW also, right?
Yep, I want to talk about that because that's why you're here.
Sure. So those two shows keep me pretty busy. You know, if I throw a third show in there, I'm pretty booked. So I only do maybe 10 to 20, maybe 10, 12 shows a year outside of that. I'll do some indie shows. What's cool is that the indie market basically has changed. We got Comic Cons now. I mean, I did WrestleCon in New Orleans, but what sucked is that at about 12 or 1 o'clock, all of our business stopped because there was somebody that had a line that was around the building. I mean, that was you. Yeah. So you're banned from West WrestleCon, by the way. You cannot go to any more WrestleCons because you took business away from everybody. This is the truth. Like, we were all killing. Man, this is great. We're all making great money, meeting all these fans. And all of a sudden, like crickets, like, like, what's going on? I thought I was doing stand-up comedy. So what is happening here? And then all of a sudden, like, oh, Stone Cold started signing. And I was like, all right, great. I mean, really? all right, cool. No, but you know, and just joking, but we, you know, I still do, you know, some autograph signs here in Comic Cons and, you know, I'll do matches here and there. It just depends. You know, you're not doing the WrestleMania matches, but you're out there and you're kissing babies and, you know, high-fiving people and doing that kind of stuff.
But did you ever have an exit strategy for leaving the business? Because when I retired, I was 38 years old. When Eddie died, he was 38 years old. That's the ultimate retirement respect.
Absolutely. Yes, for sure.
I love that guy. I was at his funeral. And
I know you were.
So I got out at 38 years of age. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was like about 90% of the other boys. I didn't have a plan. I was sitting there in San Antonio in a gated community, and I was drinking, hunting, and fishing, and doing a lot of stupid shit in any particular order you want to name.
Mm-hmm.
Then I said, hey, man, you better take your ass out there to Los Angeles and at least try to capitalize on what name you have left. So start doing some independent movies, and you know, I don't really like acting too much. I found reality television. I started podcasting, so I found my way out here.
Yeah.
My point is I didn't have a plan like most other boys. I just okay, now after 3 years of having my thumb up my ass, the R word always sounds good. Until you get there, and it's like, what do? I still need to pay my bills. I got my monthly nut, all that other stuff. And so now you're still making your appearances, that stuff, and still doing maybe 12 appearances in the ring, and you found producing in Lucha Underground and doing the stuff of GLOW, which we're going to segue into because that's pretty amazing. I was a huge GLOW fan, biggest Tina Ferrari fan in the world way back in the day.
Yeah, Ivory.
But, dude, did you have an exit strategy? Were you riding down the road one day and thinking, hey, man, once I get out of the business, maybe I should try this?
Hell no. We were wrestling.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm sad to hear that at the same time.
We ate, slept, breathed, dreamed, crapped wrestling our entire lives. It's what we did. Everything I did my entire life was to be a pro wrestler. When I played football, when I amateur wrestled in high school and college, was to be a pro wrestler. And that was it. That's the only thing I want to do my entire life. So when I became a pro wrestler, I mean, that was the best. There was no exit strategy. You just keep going. And then all of a sudden, you start seeing your idols. You know, my idols, who my family, of course, my father. Then you start seeing guys like, without naming any names, all these guys, and then all of a sudden they're still holding on to things, you know. And I always say that the movie The Wrestler could have been called The Hockey Player, The Basketball Player, could have been called anything, The Football Player. If you continually to hold on to it, we can only borrow in the ring the sports aspect of it for a short amount of time. Then we got to give it back. No one told me that. It was just like wrestling. Okay. And then we'll go into producing and stuff. And I saw my dad always just trying to hold on to it, man. He was always trying to hold on to it and go back to it. My dad had a degree. He'd become a teacher, go back to teaching and start teaching again. He'd be doing, you know, 2 or 3 years with teaching and pension and stuff. And the next one, he'd get a shot. He'd leave all that to go wrestle in Japan. And I was like, Dad, what are you doing, man? He's like, he's that bug, man. You never retire. You never fully retire from the ring. So I just started, you know, there's a time when you're in WWE and you know when you're being used, and then you know when you're not being used. Now you're like, okay, now I'm here to help everybody get better. I get it. I totally get it. And I see where it's at. I didn't need to be that. You know, they'd asked me to be an agent a couple different times and I was like, I'm not ready for that. But then I didn't want to be in my payoff was being in the ring as an agent, which was awesome. It was great. You're still on the road all the time. Man, I didn't know what to do. And then Eddie passed and then Chris passed. And it was, man, it was tough. It was like, man, do I want to keep doing this? There was about a 3-year period that me and my wife kicked around. Thank God she was on my side for sure, because she was always going, you know, if you need to leave, you leave. You do what you got to do. Now, man, I got college funds to put together. I got mortgages. I got retirement, all this stuff. I'm like, can't just leave. Finally, one time, I came home and I looked at her and said, hey, I quit. And she said, you what? I said, yeah, I quit. When did you quit? I quit last night. And she's like, okay, all right, let's do this. So I kind of sat, you know, kicked around for about 6 months.
Where were you?
WWE.
Okay.
I was in WWE and I finally, you want to know the whole story?
Yeah.
Here's the whole story. So I do already a little disgruntled there, you know, and everybody
thinks. But we all get disgruntled.
We
right?
We all should think we should, you know, we should be getting more than we should be doing. Okay, I'm better than this guy. Okay, whatever. I get it. It's what one man sees in you up there. You know, if Vince sees you up there, then doing something, that's what you're doing. You got to convince one guy, right? So, we're there and, they have one of the other shows, the Saturday shows, whatever it was. And I got to put over Yoshitatsu. No offense. He's a great guy. Great. I enjoy him very much. But I go to Johnny Ace, who's head of talent relations at the time. And I said, hey, why am I doing this? Finally, I start questioning things. Now it's a little late. I should have started questioning a couple of years before. Now I'm questioning. And he's like, well, man, you know, Chavo, you know, this show is really big in Japan. And I'm like, oh, really? That's where you're doing that? So, are we a Japanese company now? Or are we a world company? That's what I asked him. And he said, well, I get what you're saying. I get what you're talking. And I said, look, man, I just don't agree with this at all. And I think this is wrong. I was already at my breaking point.
Yeah.
So, he goes, well, you know, this is just the direction we want to go with. And I said, okay, I get it. I will do this, but, I'd like my release, please. Kind of took him off guard. He was like, what? And I said, look, I'm done. I see where I'm going. I see what this is at. I probably should have done this a bit earlier. Okay, whatever. He said, well, I got to talk to Vince about this. Okay. So I went over, did my job, put Yoshi over, went home that day. I get a call from Johnny. He says, well, you know, Vince is still trying to, kicking it around a little bit. And I'm like, all right. Well, is he going to let me go? He's not going to let me go. One of the two, you know. So I'm waiting there. And he's like, all right, don't come to TV this week. So I'm sitting home. All right. We're still paying me. All right. So then I get a call from Johnny the next week and says, hey, Vince has agreed, but there's conditions. I said, what do you mean conditions? Before, but you get your release, you're still paid for 3 months and then you can go do what you want. Right. Well, that wasn't with me. It was like, okay, anytime you got to work with anybody else, you need to let us know this. And I was like, all right, that's fair. I just needed to go. And man, I felt like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. It sucked because, man, you don't know what you're going to do. But at the same time, it's like, okay, weight's lifted off for a second. Let me chill out at home. Thank God WWE is really cool. We're giving you 3 months to contemplate it a little bit and, you know, get your feet back on your ground. So I kind of sat there for a little bit and I didn't do anything. And 6 months went by and I was like, all right, well, I still got some bills to pay and stuff. All right. You know, I didn't make Stone Cold money. So I was like, you know, I did well, but I you know, I wasn't millions and millions in the bank where everybody thinks you're on TV. You're all rich, you know?
Yeah.
So I just sat there and I was like, all right, well, let me go back to work a little bit and start doing a couple of indie things. Got a shot with Jeff Jarrett and did some things in India called Rinka King, which led to TNA. I went to TNA for a year and left there after a year. And then I didn't know what I was going to do. I kind of left wrestling for a minute, and that's when Lucha Underground called in.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
This week on Jaws Picks with Ron Jaworski, Peyton Manning.
This is Ron Jaworski. Today I am joined by legendary quarterback Peyton Manning. You know, in Philadelphia, Carson Wentz had a run of like 4 years of playing terrific quarterback, and all of a sudden he gets benched. How surprised are you by that?
It's probably a good year that there aren't many fans allowed at Philly Stadium when you agree.
You're right about that. Have you ever given thought about possibly becoming an NFL owner or a general manager of an NFL team? I've always envisioned you in that role.
Yeah, Jaws, I mean, I keep looking for that $3 billion, but I can't find it. It must be in another account that I'm not aware of. So,
hey, I got a C-note in my pocket. I'll invest.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, we'll form a group.
Download new episodes of Jaws Picks with Ron Jaworski every Wednesday and Friday on Podcast One and all your favorite podcasting platforms.